What does it mean to feel safe? We stick to the well-worn path. We lock our car doors. We close the drapes at night. But what are we afraid of? I'm Christopher Wynn. This is Strange. In this debut episode, four people tell their true stories about an encounter with the strange. Author Virginia Savage McAllister reveals for the first time her chilling brush with the Boston Strangler. Investigative journalist Jeff Gwynn takes us creepy crawling with Charles Manson's deranged family. Novelist Merritt Tierce meets a very personal threat on her own front porch. And Jeffrey Craner, co-creator of the hit podcast and novel Welcome to Night Vale, reminds us why we fear the woods at night. Let's get started. Virginia Savage McAllister pays attention to detail. How else could she have written the 848-page book, A Field Guide to American Houses? She lives in a history-filled house of her own in Dallas, the city her father was once mayor of. She's also known for her accomplished children and stepchildren, a clan of writers, musicians, and filmmakers with at least one Oscar nomination in the family. What almost no one knows about Virginia is that she had a chilling encounter with one of the most infamous serial killers of the 20th century, the Boston Strangler. In the early 1960s, more than a dozen women were sexually assaulted and murdered in the Boston area, many in their own homes. A man named Albert DeSalvo would later confess to the crimes, but he died in prison before a DNA test in 2013 linked him to the last known victim. During the time of the Boston murders, Virginia was a student in neighboring Cambridge at Radcliffe College. Here's what happened late one night.
The thing I hated the very most when I was in college was a long, cold walk from the classrooms back to our dorm a mile away. And one night after a very late class, it was particularly cold and particularly windy, and I gave in to the temptation to take a shortcut and walk home through the middle of the Cambridge Common instead of sticking to the populated streets. And as I approached the Common that night, I scanned it for people, thinking that if it was empty, it would be safe, and walked through it. And about the time I got to the middle of the Common, suddenly, almost out of nowhere, a sort of unusual man in a weird green suit just appeared and right next to me and said, you should be a model. And I just ignored him and walked faster, and he kept up with me and said, no, you need to be a model, and I'm going to help make you a model. And I took the big drawing board that was under my arm and I twisted and whapped him with it. And he fell back. And as he fell back, I felt the presence of evil and was terrified enough that I broke into a run. After a few steps, I thought I should see if he's back there chasing me. And I stopped and I turned around and I saw nothing. The entire big flat common seemed empty. I didn't see a trace of life, so I continued to run a few more steps. And I looked around and nothing, no one, not a trace of a person. So I hurried back to the dorm where I was filled with chills and fear and had to just, take a shower to wash off the feeling of evil, and never walked home that way again, at least not by myself. But the memory of him haunted me, and particularly the memory of how he just disappeared. And maybe 15 years later, I was at a used bookstore, and I just happened to see on a shelf a book called The Boston Strangler. And I thought, well, I should read that. I mean, the Strangler was really active when I was in Boston. And frankly, I didn't want to know a whole lot about him because it was scary that he was in and out of the apartments in Cambridge and in Boston. But I thought, now I can read the book. And I started into it and soon discovered that the Strangler had a second persona or personality, and that was the Measuring Man. And the women that encountered him in this described him as having on an odd green suit. And the thing that they all remarked on was how at the end of their meeting, he just disappeared into nothingness. They were saying goodbye, and then he was gone, not to be seen. And they all wondered how this person had simply evaporated into the ether. And that was when I was certain that, lo, those many years ago, I had been alone in the Cambridge Common, all alone with the Boston Strangler.
Jeff Gwynn is an award-winning investigative journalist and former books editor for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. He's also the best-selling author of numerous books of his own, tackling everything from Bonnie and Clyde to the famous shootout at the OK Corral. You see, Jeff is an obsessive researcher. So in 2014, when he published his definitive biography of the notorious Charles Manson, it was no surprise that Jeff was able to dig up new details. He even scored exclusive interviews with members of Manson's so-called family. These were the people whose helter-skelter rampage of back-to-back nights of murders terrorized Los Angeles in 1969. The victims most famously included Hollywood actress Sharon Tate, wife of director Roman Polanski. What fewer people know about the case is the bizarre training that Manson ordered his followers to undergo leading up to the murders, an activity he gave a very disturbing name, creepy crawling.
In writing my book about Charles Manson, one of the things that surprised me most was how calculating Manson was. Leslie Van Houten, one of the convicted Tate LaBianca killers, told me that nothing Charlie did was ever by accident. It was always calculated. And nothing was more of a calculation than something he called creepy crawling, a maneuver that he taught to his followers in the spring of 1969. The way that it worked was this. Charlie wanted the Manson family, about two dozen mostly drug-addled kids, to believe they had the power to enter anyone's home at any time without the people inside knowing that they were there. And so he trained them, two or three at a time, to follow him. He would tell them to dress in dark clothes. They would get in a car, and then they would drive to some of the fancier residential areas in Los Angeles. They knew some rich people, mostly rock stars. And what they would do is they would try to gain entrance into their homes. And a lot of times doors weren't locked or windows weren't completely shut. Then, while the people inside slept, the creepy crawlers would stealthily rearrange furniture. They might put the dining room table where a living room couch had been. And then they'd sneak out, knowing that when the people woke up and saw how things were different, rearranged, they'd know someone had been there inside and could have done anything they'd wanted, murdered them in their beds. And they'd also have no idea who these people were. One of the most notorious instances was recorded in the memoir of Michelle Phillips, who was one of the mamas and the papas. She and her husband, John Phillips, were founders of the group. And she remembers actually thinking she'd heard someone inside their house, got up, went out, saw some things had been moved, and looking out in the driveway, saw some furtive figures sort of disappearing into the night. The Manson family members thought that the creepy crawls were just in and of themselves the only things that were going to happen. But Manson was using them as a sort of horrible spring training for what he really intended. And in August of 1969, he led two very lethal creepy crawls, the first not in person, to the Tate residence, and the second personally to the La Bianca home. And what he did was told his followers to call on the skills they'd learned during the creepy crawls. Everybody talks about the Tate La Bianca murders, but I think they miss just how calculating Charlie Manson was in orchestrating the training he thought that his followers needed to carry out real murders. He was a terrible, terrible man, and the most frightening thing about him is he never, ever was insane. People use that now as the reason why these things happened. It wasn't that at all. Charlie Manson always knew exactly what he was doing, and the creepy crawls are proof of that.
After years of waiting tables at an upscale Dallas steakhouse and writing whenever she could, Merritt Tierce hit it big in 2014 with her debut novel, Love Me Back. The book became a critical darling and won the Texas Institute of Letters Stephen Turner Award for Best Work of First Fiction. She now lives in Denton with her family and is working on her follow-up, a dystopian novel featuring kangaroos. But Merritt still remembers those early days as a struggling writer and a single woman living alone. In fact, there is one night in particular that she will never forget.
So, about 10 years ago, I lived in Dallas in an apartment in Oak Cliff. It was this really nice, big, old craftsman-style house that had been divided into four apartments, and I lived in one of the downstairs units. And one night while I was at work, my apartment was broken into and my computer was stolen. It was just a crappy PC, but everything I had ever written was on that machine. And this was pre-cloud, so it wasn't like everything was backed up in 10 places like it is now. It was just gone. But aside from the broken window and, you know, the loss of my life's work, honestly, I don't think any of what I had written at that point was very good, but still scary for a writer. Aside from the window and the computer and the top sheet, the flat sheet from my bed, which I guess they wrapped the computer in, nothing else was missing, and there was no harm to my person, just my psyche. I was 26 years old, and I lived by myself, and I'd been living alone in Dallas for several years, and that was the first time I'd been burgled. So it was jarring, but you know, I liked living in the neighborhood, and it was close to my work, and the rent was super cheap, so I just consoled myself by getting a new computer, a Macintosh, of course. Then a couple weeks later, I woke up one morning, and there was a man asleep on my porch. I had no idea who he was, had never seen him before, and he was lying on my welcome mat. But the sun was shining, and there were lots of people hanging out in the park across the street from my house, so I didn't feel threatened the way I had in the middle of the night. So I opened the door and roused him, and he asked me if his cousin was home, which sounded kind of sketchy, but he did seem to think his cousin lived there, so I just told him no, his cousin didn't live there. And then in this sort of belated stranger danger reflex, I even said, actually, I don't live here either. I'm just visiting my friend. So I doubt I sold that, but anyway, he wandered off. And then just a few days later, I get home from work one night really late. I worked in a restaurant, and it was usually after midnight when I got home, sometimes much later. So it's late, and I'm exhausted, and I'm going straight to bed. I put on my pajamas and turn off all the lights, and I'm walking through my living room toward my bedroom, and I'm just like five steps from falling into my bed and passing out, and I hear this eerie, screechy, scraping noise right outside my living room window. So I freeze, and I hear it again, and it sounds like a branch or something is scratching the window, but there aren't any trees outside that window. And I hear it again, and it was the sound that I had never heard before. And my brain was trying to decide if it was like a gate swinging open or some vermin or what. And especially, I was trying to figure out if there was some human agent behind it, because my house had been broken into and there'd been a strange man sleeping on my porch. And I hear it again, and I become convinced that it's someone trying to get into my house, and I don't know what to do. And it's only been a couple minutes of listening to this sound, but I'm drenched in sweat because I'm so scared, and I'm just paralyzed like some kind of prey animal. And I didn't have a phone with me, because this was before my phone was like an appendage. I mean, it was probably in my car or dead, so I couldn't like call the police or tweet the police or anything. And then I hear footsteps on my porch. I mean, that sound was unmistakable. I felt the vibration under my feet, and I could hear someone walking around on my porch. And then they walk off my porch, and I hear the screechy sound again, and I decide, you know, no one's gonna save me, so I drop to my knees and crawl over to my living room window. And I raise myself up enough to peek out between the mini blinds, and sure enough, there is a man out there. It's gotta be like 2 in the morning, and there's this old guy standing about 10 feet from my window in the road. He looks kind of like Rip Van Winkle with this long, white, scraggly beard, and he's wearing overalls and a straw hat, and he's holding a fishing pole. And then I hear the sound again, and it's coming from his fishing pole. Somehow his reel is making this noise. But he's not fishing, he's standing in the middle of the road, and there's no water within casting distance, just houses and cars. And the weird thing is, when he casts, I can tell the line is connected to something way up in the air. And I look way up in the air, and it's a kite. He's flying a kite in the middle of the road in the middle of the night. So I'm relieved that, you know, he's just doing his bizarre thing out there, and it doesn't seem like it has anything to do with me. But then I'm like, what was he doing on my porch? Maybe the fisherman is what's making the sound, but maybe there's somebody else on my porch. So I crawl through my living room to my bedroom, and I peek out those blinds, and I see a tackle box on my porch and some spools of kite string and a fast food bag. So clearly the kite fishing guy's stuff, and he just set it there. I guess he thought it looked like a nice spot to set up for some night fishing. Some night kite fishing. I mean, I had a really great porch, so I don't blame him, but the porch was right off my bedroom, so I didn't feel like I could go to sleep with this strangeness happening. Anyway, I got in bed, and I got under the covers, like, all the way under the covers. Actually, just the cover, because I didn't have a top sheet anymore. And I lay there listening to that crazy sound for a couple hours until I fell asleep in spite of myself, and then when I woke up, I moved into a different neighborhood and into an upstairs apartment.
You may not recognize Jeffrey Craner's name, but you know the hit podcast he co-created, Welcome to Night Vale. The show is about a fictional desert town with some very comical and surreal problems. Scary glow clouds, a sinister dog park, weird hooded figures. Night Vale is one of the most downloaded podcast series of all time. Recently, it spawned the novel by the same name, which debuted at number 4 on the New York Times bestsellers list. As things get increasingly hectic in Craner's work, he relishes the escape of a small country house in upstate New York. The animals he spies in the surrounding woods are nothing like the ones in his native Mesquite, Texas. In fact, on one recent night, he wasn't even sure what he was looking at. Here's Jeffrey.
Our porch looks out toward the Catskills. Between our home and the eastern edge of the hills is a forest, and shaved into the forest next to our house is a flat patch of land, upon which one local farm has planted a cornfield. During the late summer, the corn is as high as the eye of a very tall animal, or whatever height is deemed correct by that old musical. In the warmer evenings, as the sun sets, my wife and I often pour a little whiskey and sit out on the deck, watching the twilight sky dim over nature. Our little home, a quarter mile off the nearest farm road and equally far from the nearest neighbor. At dusk, we can see the magnificent wildlife of upstate New York. There is a family of deer, a colony of bats that erratically dive bomb the mosquitoes, flocks of Canadian geese, woodchucks, chipmunks, squirrels. There is even a black bear that occasionally appears loafing about our yard. I usually shout, "Hi, bear," at the bear, which causes the bear to pause each time and appear socially anxious and then amble as quickly as one can amble back into the trees. I respect nature because it is beautiful and it can kill you. I am in perpetual awe at how strange and majestic all of these creatures are against the backdrop of backlit mountains and a purple-orange sky. The relentlessness of seasons and stars are mysteries to me, and I love that. I know we have Neil deGrasse Tyson and Jane Goodall and scores of scientists who have numbers and notebooks which indicate patterns and meaning, but I love the black space of unknowing that can never be explained or understood. I think that's where God lives. One night this past August, as my wife and I sipped a craft bourbon and breathed slowly together on the patio, we watched for the first stars of night, those ancient gods still alive showing us twinkling memories of their early childhoods. We watched the bats and their nonsensical paths keeping us safe from six-legged bloodsuckers. We hoped to see the bear, but it was not out that night. As daylight disappeared and the bats went to siesta, we saw a movement, something light-colored and small off to the right, on the edge of the cornfield. It was compact and bright against the night. It was moving quickly, almost a glide, but with a slight bob to its gait. "What is that?" my wife asked, pointing. "I don't know," I answered, punctuating it with some cuss word. What we felt for a fleeting moment was actually terror. How did we not know all of the kinds of animals near our home? How did something so generally familiar somehow look so completely unnatural? Was it a predator? Was it something scarier, like a shared illusion, a synchronized tear in lucidity, the confused gap between reality and context? I think that's where the devil lives. As it neared our house, we saw it. We saw what it really was, and we knew it at the exact same time. "It's a Pekingese," we said nearly in unison, but more like the delayed echo of a stadium PA. The creature was fluffy and a little golden purse dog just running about in nature, and the moment we recognized it for what it was, it sharply cut right and ran into the cornfield, and we never saw it again. We breathed together, invisible thought bubbles above our heads filled with interrobangs and WTFs, and for a while nothing made sense, and experiential certainty was but a myth. At least the bourbon was fantastic. Half an hour later, some kids, likely family campers, came running into the cornfield with flashlights and shouts, and it all made sense. But I have to say, we were sort of disappointed that it did.
Strange is produced by Christopher Wynn, that's me, and Jason Reimer, who also wrote our music. The show is mixed and engineered at Cigar Box Studios in Oak Cliff. Additional engineering on this episode was done by Brian Elledge, and special thanks goes out to Keith Reynolds with Spoke Media. For more on Strange or to send me feedback and story suggestions, I'd love to hear them, you can reach me on Twitter at Christopher Wynn. You'll also find a link to the show at dallasnews.com, including exclusive photographs. Until next time, thanks for listening, and remember to keep it strange.